So how are you at doing math in your head? You good at doing math in your head? I saw something the other day where a mom was talking to the dad, and she had to do some math, like on the fly. So she said, okay, all right, here we go. All right, so we've got to be there at 7, and we still need to eat before we go, which means we'll need to leave at 5:45, which means we need to start getting the kids ready last night. Ever been there? Math. Have you ever noticed how crazy those math problems are in school? Little Jimmy had 74 apples. If he gave Jane 2 apples and Jack 4 apples, how many apples did little Jimmy have left? Can we first just say, why in the world does little Jimmy have 74 apples? I mean, did he have a produce stand? Did he rob a produce stand? Why does this kid have so many apples? Money, math, and apples. What's the biggest math problem in the world? The biggest math problem in the universe. And what does the biggest math problem have to do with you? We continue our series, Who Are You? Where we have been trying to build a sense of conviction and confidence by trying to truly define who we are as individuals. The Apostle Paul wrote a letter to some folks in a place called Ephesus, and part of his letter proclaims the biggest math problem ever, and through his letter, he lets us know what it has to do with us. Today's message is called, It's a Question of Math, and we begin in Ephesians 2, verse 8. Paul says, for by grace you have been saved. The biggest math problem in the universe is the problem of being saved. What does it mean to be saved? And why would a person have to be saved? Michelangelo was an Italian sculptor, painter, architect, poet. He's often referred to as one of the greatest artists of all time. There's a story told that he was asked by one of his best students. His student had made this sculpture of a person. And his student asked the teacher, hey, what do you think of my sculpture? And the famed artist said this, it is magnificent. It lacks only one thing, life. That is why a person needs to be saved. They lack spiritual life. Now, they're alive in the sense that they can listen to a podcast or go to the mall. They can build a gazebo in the backyard or they can eat sushi. They're alive in all of those senses. But when it comes to their spirit, the deepest part of who a person is, there is no spiritual life if there is no salvation to God. A person is dead to God. They are separated from all that is good and holy and happy and satisfying, not for today or tomorrow for the next 10 years, but they are separated from all that is good and holy and happy and satisfying forever. To not have spiritual life becomes the biggest math problem in the universe. To have a spirit that is spiritually dead is the biggest math problem. To not be right with God is the biggest problem. But there is good news. The good news is there is a solution for that problem. And what is that solution? Well, the solution, according to Paul, in very clear language, is the grace of God. The grace of God. What is grace? A few weeks ago, we said grace is getting everything for nothing. You get everything and it's for nothing. Grace is something that is undeserved, it's unsought, and it's unbought. Bruce Hurt said this, grace is a gift that cost everything to the giver and nothing to the receiver. It is given to those who don't deserve it, barely recognize it, and hardly appreciated. The solution of the problem of being saved is found in the grace of God and God alone. And all the math belongs to God. Every part of the equation is His. Jesus, the Christ, the Messiah, came from heaven to earth. He was born in a manger, truly God and truly baby. And when He grew to be a man, He was crucified on a cross outside of Jerusalem. And His crucifixion was necessary because He is, was, and will always be the only perfect substitute, the only perfect stand-in for sin. Only Jesus can satisfy the penalty of the sin of the world. This was all the sovereign plan of God from before the foundations of the world. God's grace cost Him everything, most specifically His Son. And He freely offers that grace to all who receive. He offers grace to people who don't deserve it, who barely recognize it, and hardly appreciate it. But this is what God's grace does. God, through His grace, brought a solution for the problem of sin. God brought a solution to the biggest math problem in the universe. And the solution, the only solution, is salvation through Jesus Christ, because Jesus is the only one who could and has satisfied the ultimate penalty of sin. Someone said that grace starts with God, it continues with God, and it ends with God. And our part in the grace of God is simply response. The most we have when it comes to the grace of God is responding to what God has already first done. Without the work of God through His Son, Jesus Christ, there is no hope for the biggest math problem in the universe. Now, someone may say, well, gosh, if all the math is God's, what are we? We just a bunch of robots, just controlled by God? No, listen to what Paul says next. For by grace you have been saved through faith. God's math includes our faith. We are saved by grace through faith. How does all that work? Well, I don't know. No clue. It's one of the most marvelous, miraculous mysteries in all of time. Past, present, future, and infinity. But it's not an irrational mystery. I heard someone describe it in super simple terms. It's as if grace is water and faith is the water hose. They described it like this. The water is the ultimate defining part, and it gets to us through the hose. But the hose does not quench your thirst. The water does. It's the grace of God that actually quenches the thirst of our soul. The picture that Paul is painting is that we are not just saved by faith. We are saved by grace through faith, but the faith does matter. Augustine said this, He who created you without you, just in case you forgot that, okay? You didn't create yourself in your mother's womb. You didn't do that. He who created you without you will not save you without you. God doesn't do the believing. We do the believing. So the question is this, do you believe? Has the grace of God quenched the thirst of your soul? Have you believed in Jesus? Have you trusted in Jesus? But more importantly, are you still believing in Jesus? And are you still trusting in Jesus? The language of John 3:16 is not just, oh, believe one time at camp or believe one time at the front of church. It is believing the first time and believing and believing and believing and believing. Trusting, trusting, trusting. Are you a believer? Do you believe? Do you trust in Jesus? And how can you know if you're believing? How can you know if you're trusting? How can you know if you have been saved by grace through faith? How can you know if your faith is actually activated and still active? Well, think of it this way. Imagine you do go to a youth camp, a children's camp, or you're at a service on Sunday morning, or you're listening to a podcast, and you hear the truth about the gospel. And as you hear it, you go, you know what? This is making a connection with me. I think I really do believe these things about Jesus. I think I believe they're real. That's great. That's good. But you can also believe that if you have the app for Jumpin' Jehoshaphat's coffee shop and you go to Jumpin' Jehoshaphat's coffee shop on your birthday and show them the app, you'll get a free coffee, right? I mean, you believe that's true. But if you don't go to Jumpin' Jehoshaphat's and let them scan your app, you ain't getting no coffee, right? But let's say you do go and they scan your app and you get the coffee. That's all you're getting. You just got a cup of coffee. But then let's imagine that you go every single day. Man, sometimes three times a day. You cannot get enough of that particular coffee. It is so great. And finally, you're like, I can't take it anymore. So you quit your job over at American Panascope. And then you say, you know what? I'm going to take all my money and I am going to go buy Jumpin' Jehoshaphat's, and that's going to be my life. I'm going to pour myself into that coffee shop. Come on, that was good. Now, I know that might be an over-caffeinated illustration there, but just hang with me here. One, you can't go buy your salvation, okay? That's not the purpose of the story. But the picture rings true. It's not enough for you just to say, I think these things about Jesus are true. Saving faith is more than scanning your app on Sunday mornings. Saving faith means there has to be movement. That in your mind, in your heart, with your money, with your time, with your whining, complaining, grumbling attitude, everything must change. To believe in Jesus means you move toward Jesus and you move away from you. And what's amazing is this, the more you do it, the more you are satisfied. That's the very nature of who Jesus is. But saving faith, it requires surrender. It requires yielding. And those are things that we really just don't like. We don't like the concept of surrendering and yielding. I can't remember if it was in the choir song or the hymn, but the word humility went across the screen. Can I just say, as Americans, we hate humility. We do. We don't like it. Because it forces us to be servants even when we don't want to serve. It forces us to love when love feels impossible. But I can promise you, there is nothing more impossible than you being rescued from sin on your own. But Jesus loved, and he sacrificed innocently so that we might be saved. Do you have that kind of saving faith that yields and surrenders to Jesus? John Patton, more than 100 years ago, lived amongst some islands in the South Pacific Ocean, and one of the things he was trying to do was translate the Bible in a language for the people there on the islands. But he kept hitting a wall with this one particular translation. He couldn't find a word or a phrase in their language that translated belief, trust, and faith. There wasn't anything like that in their culture. And then one day he was working in his hut, and some guy in the village that he knew just came in and plopped himself down in a chair in John Patton's hut. And he's like, man, I'm exhausted. And then he said something. And this is what he said. He said it in his old language. I don't know what the language was, so I won't use that. But what it translated as was this. It's so good to rest my whole weight in this chair. Patton went, ding, 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 ding. There's my word. There's my phrase. So have you rested the whole weight of your spirit on Jesus Christ, who sits in his eternal chair on yonder throne? Not just do you believe, are you believing? Not just did you trust, but are you trusting? Are you yielding? Are you surrendering? Are you being satisfied with Jesus? Those are the questions that ultimately answer, who are you? Listen to what Paul says next in verse 8. And this salvation, this faith, is not of yourselves. It is the gift of God. Do you know what your credit score is right now? For some of our younger people who don't know what credit scores are, don't worry. I'm getting ready to define it. Credit score, according to Wikipedia, goes like this. A credit score is a numerical expression based on a level of analysis of a person's credit files to represent the credit worthiness of that person. Isn't that a great word? Credit worthiness. I just love that word. In other words, can this person be trusted to pay their bills? Can this person be trusted with a loan? Can they be trusted with some level of financial responsibility? Can they be trusted? Because that's what people want to know before they hand you the keys to a car or the keys to a house. Or these days, with the prices of things, the keys to a blender, right? I mean, it's just one of those things. They want to know, hey, I think this person can be responsible. Now let's pull that creditworthiness into spiritual life. Spiritually speaking, without the grace of God through faith, your credit score is zero. But that's the math. Without the grace of God, our credit score is zero. So how can you get your credit score to change? Well, here's a few things that will not automatically change your credit score. A sinner's prayer will not automatically change your credit score. Getting baptized will not automatically change your credit score. Joining a church will not automatically change your credit score. Packing an Operation Christmas Child shoebox for Christmas will not automatically change your spiritual credit score. Those are all good things, but those things by themselves are not enough to make things right between you and God. The only way to be right with God is by His grace. To be saved by His grace through faith. Now, someone may ask, man, once again, if God has all the math, why isn't He nicer? Why is God a God who will allow people to go to hell? By the way, we all send ourselves to hell. God sends no one to hell. It is our sin and rebellion that separates us from God. And so people say, well, why is God so mean? Why is He so demanding? Why are all these things so impossible? The real question is this: how is it possible that anyone would get into heaven? How is it possible that a single person could ever enter into the beauty and the majesty and the perfection of God without His grace? Is a bank going to loan a guy $853,000 to go buy a new house when his credit score is 244? If you don't know anything about credit scores, the answer would be no. So in saying that salvation is not from us, and saying that even our faith is a reflection of the kindness of God, Paul is saying that we can offer up the purest thing in our lives to God, and it will not be enough to change our score. How in the world do you think we can make leverage with the perfection and holiness of God when our spiritual credit scores is zero? Now, someone may be thinking, I don't like this. I don't like it. I don't like how it sounds. It makes it sound like we're helpless. Yes! Yes! We are helpless. That's exactly what it's supposed to mean. Do you want to go to the doctor and the doctor says, hey, here's a roll of Tums. Go home and chew on these and call me back in a month, when he knows, because he saw the results, that there's a disease eating up your stomach? Is that what we want? Doctor, just give me some Tums. I'll be all right. But for some reason, we expect God to say, well, hey, since you got your mother a Mother's Day gift, I mean, since you went to church, since you gave some money, since, you know, you put your kids through college, since you worked hard at your job, hey, everybody goes to heaven. Nothing's a big deal. But unlike me, and unlike you, and unlike every other person on this planet, God cannot lie. We can lie. We've probably all done it at least once this week. Even if we didn't know we were doing it. But God cannot lie. He can only give the truth. And what is the truth he gives? Well, here's one truth he gives. Paul just said it a few sentences before. Ephesians 2, verse 1. And you were dead in your offenses and sins. Before God saves a person by grace through faith, that person is spiritually dead, helpless, hopeless. Their credit score is zero. Someone may say, that's terrible news. Is there any good news? Well, I hate to tell you, there's not. There is no good news. There is only great news. There's only fantastic news. There's only wonderful news when it comes to the grace of God. And here is that news. Jesus saves. Jesus saves. By the grace of God through faith, Jesus saves. It's what he does. Your spiritual credit score can change, and don't miss this, it can change and never change again. It can be changed and maxed out at the highest spiritual credit score you could ever have, and it will never change. How? Why? Because when it comes to the grace of God, your credit is the blood of Jesus Christ. And the blood of Jesus Christ never loses its value and never loses its power. Your bank account will lose its power. Your family structure will lose its power. Your politicians, your government, your health, your favorite team on any given Saturday in the fall will lose its power, but not the blood of Jesus. It's not possible for the blood of Christ to lose any of its power. And that's our credit. Our credit is not that we can preach or sing or give money or do anything else that's really nice in the Christian realm. Our credit is the blood of Christ and only the blood of Christ, nothing else. But it's everything we need. Paul gives this just one more image, verse 9. Not a result of works, so that no one may boast. This grace, this salvation, this faith, it's not a result of works so that no one can boast. No one. No one can say, oh, I did this. I mean, think about the reality of this. There is no one who will make it into God's heaven, who will get through the gates and go, yes, I did it. And there is no one who will make it into God's heaven, get through the gates, go give the Messiah a high five and say, yes, Jesus, we did it. No, for us, we will be stunned and amazed that there is any ability to cross that threshold. And we will, for 10,000 years to infinity, speak of the majesty and the glory of God, and we will never tire of that, and we will never long to have our name on a brass plaque anywhere. We'll never long for us to be the most important person in the church, or important person at home, or important person in work, or important person anywhere, because we will be so mesmerized with the love and the grace and the mercy of God, and we will be satisfied, satisfied in Him. I was reading a story about a man named David. David suddenly died at a fairly young age, 56, and at his funeral, boy, people just, they just went on and on. There was a time of sharing, and boy, people just shared and shared about what a remarkable, godly, wonderful man David was. And after this time of sharing, David's pastor finally got up and he just simply said this: none of the good things David did earned him 1 second in heaven. He is there because he received God's salvation through Christ. No matter how grand someone's funeral may be, the only thing that could ever make someone's funeral grand is if they know Christ. Liz Wan is a wife and mom, lives in Philadelphia. A few years ago, when her sons were a little bit younger, she was writing about one particular struggle in life, and she used it describing a math problem, and this is what she said: I have one big math problem taking over my life right now, namely, potty training my 2-year-old. Yeah, been there? I just want the problem solved, and I don't want to deal with the process. It's hard to navigate all the failures, all the setbacks, and all the change. Moms, you ever been there? Of any age, have you ever had moments as a mother when you felt failure, setback, or change? When you felt like no matter how hard you were working, that no one was listening, no one was paying attention, and you were just having to do everything on your own? Ever felt that way? That's not just for moms either, right? It could be any of us. But it was in that moment, as she was overwhelmed with this sense of failure, of not being perfect, of things changing, and just not really sure what to do, that this thing came into Liz's mind, and she wrote it down. And the wording that she used is this: there is a message more important than mothering. That's what she wrote. There's a message more important than potty training, more important than whatever's in the blank. There's a message more important than mothering. And what's that message? Well, she wrote it down right after the next sentence. This is the message. This is what she wrote: for by grace you have been saved through faith, and this is not of yourselves, it is the gift of God, not a result of works, so that no one may boast. That is the greatest Mother's Day message that could ever be preached. That's the greatest Father's Day message, the greatest Arbor Day message, the greatest Christmas, Easter. You name the holiday, the event, you name any day of the week, that is the message above all other messages. By grace, you have been saved. By grace, you have been saved. By grace, you have been saved. Liz goes on. She says, as parents, our works will never make us good enough for God or for our children. Once we believe this truth, we can walk in the fullness of God's good works for us. We must embrace the process of becoming what we already are until we are complete in God's presence. I know we don't think about that. I mean, really, most of us are like, gosh, Dad, would you finish? I'm hungry, and we're going out to eat afterwards. That's our minds, you know? But man, what a glorious thing in the middle of everything going wrong for us to be able to say, man, I am going to be in the presence of God one day. That changes everything. But then Liz says this, mothers, the biggest math problem in history has already been solved for us. What about it, moms, grandmoms, and anybody else who can hear this question? Has the biggest math problem in history been solved for you? Have you, by grace, through faith, been saved? Who are you?